Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour,
a book of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's correspondence reveals the politics of the past and how it has changed.
But first, as California burns, oceans rise, and Greenland's glaciers melt, we explore solutions to the climate change problem with Stanford professor Mark Jacobson. Mark Jacobson is a Stanford University professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Atmosphere Energy Program, senior fellow at two institutes for energy and the environment, and the co-founder of the Solutions Project. He has authored two textbooks, over 160 peer-reviewed articles, has testified four times before Congress, and won numerous academic and civic awards for his work. Welcome back to the Scholar Circle, Mark Jacobson. It's great to have you back here with us. A lot has happened in the last year since we had you on last, I think. And of course, from the time we first met, which was back in 2009, when you first published the paper in Scientific American about how we power the whole world with 100% renewables. Before we go into your research on carbon capture, which is what I primarily wanted to focus on, I thought we should contextualize the whole thing within the context of what's happening today. I thought now, as California is riddled with fire and the oceans are rising and changing and glaciers receding, storms intensifying, I wanted to get a sense of the urgency that we're facing. How urgent is it now to act quickly?
Oh, it's very urgent that we act without any further ado to transition the entire world's energy infrastructure and also non-energy emissions as well. To entirely clean renewable energy to the extent we can. And that means electricity, transportation, building, heating and cooling, and industry. So we need to transition as fast as possible to eliminate all combustion emissions, and that includes the fossil fuels and biofuels.
Do you know what happened that scientists seem to have underestimated the speed with which the climate has been changing now? It sounds they're all saying, you know, we were off and it's getting worse a lot faster than we predicted. What happened?
Well, I mean, I think there are some camps, of scientists that felt that, you know, there was an urgency that things were getting bad really rapidly. And then there are others who are slower. And then there are others, then there's a whole group of people who say, well, there's no problem whatsoever. And the carbon dioxide is not a problem to climate at all. So I think what you're saying is really the fact that, you know, we've been struggling with a lot of people who've been denying climate change, dominating the conversation. And so as a result, nothing was getting done. And now we're just seeing some of these impacts that people have been talking about for a while coming to fruition. And so, you know, even the climate deniers are starting to be quiet more. And now we really have to face the reality. So it's something that it was always cooking in the system. I mean, I don't necessarily think it was myself that it was any faster than we thought, because I think the problem is actually a lot worse than we think it is, than most people think it is. The reason is because air pollution, which kills 7 million people per year worldwide, also masks about half of global warming. So as we clean up all air pollution, which we need to do to save people's lives, we're going to uncover rapidly even more warming, you know, half the latent global warming that people don't even see, because the pollution particles, they reflect light, and so they cool the surface air, and they also enhance cloudiness, which also cools the surface air. So these pollution particles have been masking or hiding about half of global warming. And now, as you start cleaning up pollution particles, you're going to see this unmasking and even faster warming than people thought.
So you're saying that, for example, as we make the switch to renewable energies and we are not putting more pollution into the air, that simultaneously we have to deal with those emissions that have been masked?
Yes. Now, it's a little even more complicated, because some of those pollution particles cause warming. Most of them cause cooling, but some do cause warming. And we want to eliminate both because of their health effects. But at the same time, then there's invisible carbon dioxide, which causes warming as well, and also other gases, greenhouse gases like halogens, such as chlorofluorocarbons and hydrofluorocarbons. and also nitrous oxide and methane. These all cause warming as well. And we need to reduce not only CO2, but also the halogens, the nitrous oxide, the methane, also ozone, which is not emitted, but is formed from air pollutants, but it's a gas. All those need to be reduced simultaneously. So when as we reduce the air pollutants that cause health problems, mostly the particles in the ozone, we will also be reducing the greenhouse gases. So we'll be causing some warming due to the reduction of the cooling particles, but we'll also be reducing warming due to the reduction of the CO2 and the remaining warming particles. So if I haven't confused you.
I don't think so. No, I think it's all right. Let's go back also and again encapsulate your work with that work you did in 2009, which was looking at all the different variables and all the different outcomes from renewables versus all these other models that included, say, for example, you know, some natural gas or some other types of energy, nuclear. And you found that really the wind, water, solar won on all fronts, including economic. Can you give us another reminder, just to remind people of how you measure that and what your outcome was in 2009, and any update on that in the meantime?
Yeah, so 2009, I did a study, well, I guess it started in 2008, in that period, I did a study looking at what were the best technologies, what were the technologies being proposed to address global warming, air pollution, and energy security. And these included like wind, onshore and offshore wind, solar, photovoltaics on rooftops and in power plants, concentrated solar power, geothermal, tidal, wave power, hydroelectric power. Those I call wind, water, solar options. But in addition to those, people have been proposing nuclear power, coal, and natural gas with carbon capture, and which is where you try to extract the carbon dioxide from the emissions of the power plant. And also biofuels was also being promoted quite a bit. So I evaluated all of these technologies in terms of a bunch of different criteria, all like their health impacts, their climate impacts, their impacts on land areas, on water supplies, on security risks, on materials and whatnot. And in fact, there were about 12 different criteria that I looked at, and I ranked all these and found that the wind and water and solar options were the best in terms of trying to solve the problem of climate change and air pollution and energy security simultaneously, whereas nuclear power, coal with carbon capture, and biofuels were not so good. And it doesn't mean some of them weren't better than fossil fuels on their own, but they just were not as good as were the wind, water, solar options. And I got attacked quite a bit for that, mostly by the people in the industries that weren't ranked very high. And anyway, it's proven since then that nuclear power is way expensive. It's 4 to 5 times more than wind and solar energy right now per unit energy, and takes about 5 to 17 years longer to implement. And in addition to having meltdown risk, weapons proliferation risk, waste issues, mining issues. So that is pretty much off the table in terms of a solution to global warming, but it's taken about 10 years for most people to figure that out. And biofuels, although they're still around, most people see that they also cause air pollution because you still burn them, and they still cause global warming even though you grow crops and take out carbon from the air. To do that, it takes a lot of energy to actually cultivate the crops and fertilize them and water them and then refine them into a biofuel. And so that's turned out to not, people now understand that that's not a good solution. The land use is just so enormous for biofuels that doesn't work. Now, the last main bastion of trying to avoid going to clean renewable energy is this thing called carbon capture and sequestration, or carbon capture and use, which is where the carbon dioxide from a power plant or from some industrial process is captured by some equipment. Usually it's a chemical process, although there are some electrical processes now that try to capture the CO2. And then it's usually there's no financial benefit of just capturing the CO2 and putting it underground. So the only companies that are actually doing this these days are taking that CO2 and selling it. And the only people who really are buying this en masse right now are oil companies, the CO2 that is. And the CO2 in some places that where capture is being done is really being piped to an oil well where it's being pumped into the oil well to bind with the oil and reduce its density so that the oil comes to the surface faster so you can get more oil per ton of CO2 added. And so you might say, well, how does that help the climate if you're just getting more oil to burn? In fact, it doesn't, because not only that, about half of that CO2 leaks somewhere along the line, and even more of it gets bound into the oil, which burns and releases more CO2 to the air. So we don't even know if any of that CO2 stays captured, and it just increases oil consumption and combustion. It's and more CO2, more pollution. So this is being proposed as the solution to global warming, and it's on its face, it's pretty ridiculous. But I just did a study looking at quantifying the actual emissions associated with carbon capture and use from an existing plant in Texas where capture equipment was put on a coal plant, an existing coal plant. And I looked at the data that was provided by the coal plant provided to the Department of Energy. Well, so it turns out that this coal plant, there was carbon capture was added to it. It cost $1 billion just for this carbon capture equipment, which translates into about $4,200 per kilowatt installed. And to put that in perspective, you know, 1 kilowatt of a wind turbine is about $1,000. So this is just the capture equipment alone was four times per kilowatt, four times the cost of a wind turbine. But okay, that's the best part of it. So it turns out you need a lot of energy to power this capture equipment. So they built a natural gas plant just to run the carbon capture equipment for the coal plant. And not only that, none of the carbon dioxide from the natural gas plant is captured, it's just released to the air. And plus, you need to run the gas plant, you need gas. So you also have to go mine gas, dig it up, and 2.3% of all the methane, or the natural gas, because natural gas is about 91% methane, about 2.3% of all the natural gas leaks to the air, but before it even gets to the natural gas plant. So you have to account for that leakage and the fact that methane over a 20-year time frame has about an 84 times the global warming impact is carbon dioxide per unit mass. So it's 84 times more powerful. So you have to account for that. And all the other emissions associated with mining the gas and also mining the coal that went into the plant. So, you know, people have claimed that carbon capture equipment reduces about 90% of the carbon dioxide from the coal plant. But in fact, when you actually look at the data and you count for all the upstream emissions and the combustion emissions of both the natural gas and the coal, you find that over a 20-year time frame, only about 10.5 to 11% of the carbon equivalent emissions, which are the emissions of carbon dioxide plus the equivalent emissions of carbon dioxide after you convert all the methane to carbon dioxide in terms of its warming, only 10 to 11% is actually captured. The rest, you know, on the order of 80, 90, 90% is released to the air. And this is for $1 billion you're doing this. Hardly capturing any carbon, but even to make matters worse, the carbon capture equipment doesn't reduce any air pollution from the coal. But instead, now you have a natural gas plant, and now you have 25% more air pollution than you did with the coal alone. So it increases the air pollution, hardly reduces the carbon, costs an enormous amount more. So it's a complete boondoggle. I looked at not only the actual case, but I thought, okay, well, you could probably make this better. Let's say you used a wind turbine instead of the natural gas to power the capture equipment. Well, okay, if you do that, yeah, you do reduce the emissions associated with natural gas. But then you have to think, okay, what if we just use that wind turbine to replace the coal in the first place? So it turns out, because if you do that, if you just replace the coal in the first place with the wind turbine, you don't need to buy the capture equipment. And you eliminate all the air pollution associated with the coal, and you eliminate all the mining and infrastructure associated with the coal. Whereas the carbon capture equipment, it doesn't reduce any air pollution from the coal. It costs money for the equipment itself. It doesn't reduce any mining or other infrastructure, no coal trains or holding facilities or coal or anything related to coal. So I looked and found that, any investment, even in wind power and carbon capture, basically increases carbon dioxide, increases air pollution, increases total cost relative to using that same wind just to replace the coal in the first place. So there's zero benefit of carbon capture at all, and there can never be for capturing carbon from a coal plant or a gas plant. It's always better to take that same energy that you're using for the capture equipment and replacing the coal or the gas in the first place. You're always going to get a better benefit.
One of the arguments they were making, which you started to address, was about reusing that carbon for something. And you said right now it's only fossil fuels that are using it. But they have argued, the proponents of carbon capture, that you can also use it for medicine and for biodegradable plastics. Is there any validity to that?
Well, you can use it for you can use carbon dioxide for a lot of things, but there are actually more efficient ways to get carbon dioxide than this. For example, that'll actually help to save the planet. For example, trapping methane from a landfill and then using that methane, because we're like methane, if you don't trap it from the landfill, it's going to really go to the air in any case. But when you trap the methane from a landfill, you don't need equipment. You don't need carbon capture equipment, for example. All you have is basically a bag, or a pipe, to send it somewhere to where, because the methane, it's already pretty isolated. The natural gas is already pretty isolated. So then you take the natural gas and you use it in a fuel cell to produce hydrogen. And then that hydrogen can be used for transportation. Now, the product of natural gas going through a fuel cell to produce hydrogen is carbon dioxide. So there you have a stream of carbon dioxide that is a pure stream that can be used for all those purposes. But you don't need the carbon capture equipment for that. And you're also producing hydrogen, which you'll need anyway, which will otherwise be produced from clean renewable energy anyway. So here's a way to take some waste that's going to go to the air anyway, that's 84 times more powerful than CO2 over 20 years, and converting it into two useful products, as opposed to trying to keep this coal plant alive. That has no air pollution associated with it, has zero emissions associated. I'm saying that being the trapping the methane from the landfill and then using it in a fuel cell for hydrogen and then taking that CO2 and using that for these other processes, that has zero emissions associated with it and no energy except for the energy for this. It's a steam reformer that produces the hydrogen, and then the hydrogen is used in a fuel cell. So that has no energy associated with it, whereas using the carbon capture in a coal plant to try to capture carbon, that has equipment cost for that. That it doesn't reduce any air pollution, still allows the air pollution from the coal to continue. It allows all the upstream mining to continue. It allows the whole coal system to continue. In fact, it makes it even easier to use more coal and to use more natural gas. So there's no comparison. There's absolutely no need for a stream of CO2 from that process.
You also mentioned the opportunity costs. I assume you're talking about both time investment and money investment.
Well, opportunity costs, what I usually mean is by doing that, like adding carbon capture equipment to a coal or gas plant, as opposed to taking the same energy for that capture equipment and use it, let's say it's renewable energy, and using it to replace the coal or the gas in the first place. So the opportunity cost really means the cost in terms of emissions and actual money, and it could be time as well, of doing one thing versus another that are equivalent. In terms of the energy.
You talked about the best carbon capture methods are really the ones nature's provided. They're called trees. I saw a paper about this, about what it could mean if we did get really serious about planting trees. What can you tell us about this, the idea of planting trees as a means of carbon capture, in contrast to trying to do it this other way?
So the first step is actually replacing fossil fuels with renewables. Is the exact same thing as carbon capture, because by preventing carbon dioxide from getting into the air, one molecule from getting to the air, that's like taking one molecule out of the air. It's the exact same thing. So the first step is to replace, to stop the emissions, and that's replace all the fossil fuel, not only power plants, but industrial processes, transportation CO2, replace them with clean renewable alternatives, which there are for pretty much everything right now. There's an alternative that doesn't result in any emissions. And then after that, in addition to that, to take some carbon out of the air, well, yeah, planting trees helps. We don't need to cover the planet with trees. We need to increase the reduction of CO2 from the air. Not only replanting trees, it's avoiding permanent deforestation. I mean, we can put policies in place around the world to reduce the tree loss due to permanent deforestation. Permanent deforestation is where you burn down like part of the Amazon, for example, to convert these really dense forests into cattle grazing land. So permanence, when you change the land use, as opposed to temporary deforestation where there's a forest fire and it regrows. Of course, big trees will take 80 years to regrow, so you're not like an immediate regrowth. So if we can reduce biomass burning, both permanent and annual biomass burning, that can go, and that includes wildfires, that can go a long way towards also effectively planting trees. But there are all other things we have to do to reduce warming, and that's to reduce halogen emissions, to reduce nitrous oxide emissions, to reduce methane leakage emissions. I touched upon methane from landfills, but there's also methane from rice paddies. There's methane from cattle as well and other sources. So there are other things that are low-hanging fruit that we could also try to reduce that don't require this capture equipment. Because the capture equipment is literally the worst thing to use because it always requires energy and it doesn't reduce any other pollutants. In the case of even when you're taking it out of directly out of the air, it's not reducing any other pollutants except for CO2.
Now, you and your colleagues have been working with cities, states, countries, and have written a bunch of reports about how to go to 100% renewables by 2050. Now, first and probably most pressing question is, isn't 2050 perhaps a little slow now, given what we're seeing?
Well, all our plans have been to go to 80% renewables by 2030. And the last 20% somewhere between 2030 and 2050, ideally before 2050, but that's kind of the drop dead date. So yeah, you're right. If we just all of a sudden did it all in 2050, that would be too late. But our goals are very aggressive, trying to get 80% by 2030. And that, in fact, is more aggressive than any intergovernmental panel on climate change scenario. Where they basically have like 40% by 2030, 40 or 50 at the most. But 80%, I think, we can avoid 1.5 degree global warming with that transition if we can do it worldwide, not only for all energy, but also all other emissions that are non-energy emissions.
So what are, say, some steps that need to be made? You can give some examples because I know you guys have done reports for different states and different countries. And can you give us an example of how some state or some country or some city can do this and do this quickly?
Well, the idea is to electrify everything and then provide the electricity with clean renewable energy. So transportation, we go to electric vehicles and hydrogen fuel cell for long distance heavy transport. For buildings, we'd go to heat pumps for both air heating and air cooling and water heating and even water cooling or refrigeration. And then for industry, we'd use electric high-temperature industrial processes that exist, like arc furnaces, induction furnaces, resistance furnaces. Then we provide all the electricity with clean renewable energy, like wind and water and solar power. So, and the people can do this in their own homes. I mean, you can think of what do I have that burns a fossil fuel? Well, you might have a natural gas stove. Well, instead of using that, use an electric induction cooktop stove. You might have a gas water heater, air heater. Okay, we'll go to a heat pump instead for both air heating and water heating and air conditioning. And you might have a gasoline or diesel car. Well, go to an electric car. And then you can also make your house more efficient with energy efficient light bulbs, reducing heat loss through cracks by weatherizing your home. And basically try to electrify your own home. And this is the same thing as any building can do. There are actually now 205 international companies, including 8 out of the 10 biggest companies of the world, that have committed to 100% clean renewable electricity for their global operations. So companies realize this is an important goal. And worldwide, there are over 230 cities that have made similar commitments. And there are 61 countries, actually, that have commitments for 100% renewable electricity worldwide. However, electricity is not enough. We also have to transform transportation to electrify that, building, heating, and cooling, and industry. So those are basically the steps. It's electrify, electrify, electrify.
And states in the U.S., I know California is quite working on it. I think Virginia has made a big commitment.
Yeah, there are 9 states, plus the District of Columbia and Puerto Rico, that have all committed to 100% renewable electricity between 2032 and 2050. But then again, they haven't committed to the other sectors aside from electricity, but anyway, that's a start. And there's still quite a few states because they're some of the biggest, well, California, of course, and most recently Virginia, but also Hawaii was the first, and Washington State, and Maine, now Wisconsin is another one, and New York. And so these, New Mexico, these states have all, a lot of them have good resources. Well, every state has some resources, some have better than the others. And California is actually right now at about 55% clean renewable energy, or what we call wind, water, solar. In the annual average. So in other words, 55% of all California's electricity is generated by either solar, wind, or hydroelectric power and geothermal power right now, which is pretty good. So they have a law to go to 70% by 2030, but I think we'll actually get to 70% by the early 2020s and maybe get to 100% by before 2030.
And do you have a sense, and I don't know if this is even measurable, but if all of these movements to power 100% from renewables is enough to sort of counter the backward steps of presidents like Trump and Bolsonaro?
In fact, part of the passing of the laws has been a reaction to the federal government not taking any action. And thing is, communities, individuals, communities and counties and states can do a lot. I mean, you don't necessarily need the federal government in a place like the U.S. where you have a bunch of individual states to solve the problem. Of course, the federal government is necessary, will help solve the problem and is currently even providing tax incentives to help. And that's what's driving also a lot of the transition, is the fact that there's still a federal tax credit. So the federal government can speed it up and definitely, but it could also slow it down by like preventing permits for certain things and not giving incentives. But despite what the federal government here has been doing, there has been a lot of action. In fact, coal has been dropping as a result of all this action. So like when Trump was elected, I think coal was producing around 42% of U.S. electricity. Now it's somewhere around 25%. And several coal companies are going bankrupt. I think the biggest coal producer went bankrupt today.
Yeah, I saw that. Might have been on your Twitter feed.
Yeah, so there has been, it's not because of necessarily the policy, it's just the economics of wind and solar by their mass production have driven their prices down so much that they outcompete coal. I mean, the nice thing about renewables is they have no fuel cost. The wind comes right to the turbine, the solar comes right to the panel. There's no fuel costs, whereas coal and gas, you always have to dig it up. In fact, in the United States, there are 50,000 new oil and gas wells drilled every year just to dig up these fossil fuels. And so that means that their prices or costs are going to stay high. They're never going to come really low like wind and solar are, because you don't need any fuel costs with wind and solar.
So a lot of the naysayers also arguing that, China and India are mass polluters and emitters of climate change emissions. But China is embarking on renewables at a fairly rapid pace, aren't they?
Yeah, considering their size, they are producing more solar and wind than pretty much all the other countries. So that even though compared to the size of their energy, it's not a huge percent yet. It's still, compared to the size of the renewables in the world, it's the largest. So they are doing a lot, but they can do more. And they're also doing things in transportation. They're electrifying buses, by the tens of thousands, starting to get into electric aircraft, or starting to get into all sorts of electric alternatives. because they have huge air pollution problems. I mean, there's 7 million people die per year from air pollution, and maybe between 1 and 1.5 million of those are in China. And so this is a country that's trying to preserve itself. It's self-preservation in that case by electrifying and cleaning up the air. The U.S. has cleaned up a lot of its air pollution, but still has a lot in Los Angeles, for example, and in fact, 7 of the 10 most polluted cities in the U.S. are in California. So there is actually motivation in California to clean up as well, and also other states. But China has, an order of magnitude higher pollution. And so they are making progress, but to self-preserve themselves.
I suppose the other area that has been criticized for doing renewables is energy storage, both because of, times when you might not have sun or wind, but also with, say, electrified transportation as well. How are we advancing technology with storage? Are there advances that are really promising?
Yeah, storage, there's storage in of not only electricity, but there's heat storage, cold storage, and hydrogen storage. And actually, heat storage and cold storage are relatively inexpensive, and hydrogen storage is not a whole lot either. It's mostly been electricity storage, but there are actually certain types of electricity storage that are not that expensive either, like hydroelectric power is basically a big battery. Pumped hydroelectric storage is the most common type of storage in the U.S., and that's not that expensive. Concentrated solar power with storage, even though concentrated solar power itself is relatively still more expensive than PV, but the storage, though, is actually not very much. It's mostly batteries that are the expensive electricity storage, but those have been coming down. And, there are additional type. There are different types of batteries that are being developed as well. Some are less expensive. They're also, there's gravitational storage where you have concrete blocks, you lift them up and you drop them down. You lift them up when you have extra electricity and you drop them down when you need electricity. Those are not that expensive. It's like pumped hydro. Same with, trains moving up and down a hill. That's a type of electricity storage. And that's not so expensive either, although those latter two haven't been commercialized. So we don't know exactly what their costs are, or they're just starting to be commercialized. And then there's also compressed air storage, and there's different types. We don't know exactly what their costs are because it's new technology. Compressed air, like liquefying the compressed air, so make it even smaller volumes. And so that has some potential, but again, it's really new, so we don't know what its cost is. But yeah, there are options.
Do you have a sense that these new technologies are going to provide solutions for intermittence that we might be facing in the future if we do go to 100% renewables globally?
Well, right now, battery storage with solar or wind is very cheap. Now, this is like storage for on the order of hours to days. It's not like months storage, but it's hours to day storage. So that reduces the minutely fluctuations in renewables. But it's really cheap. We're talking 3 cents a kilowatt hour for the combination of solar plus batteries. And that compares with 6 cents a kilowatt hour for natural gas combined cycle, which is mostly baseload. Peaker plant natural gases are like 18 cents a kilowatt hour. So solar plus batteries beating out natural gas right now. So same with wind plus batteries. But that's, for short-term storage batteries. And, for seasonal fluctuations, though, people are concerned that, how are we going to, get all the electricity we'll need in the wintertime when we need a lot of heating, if we electrify the heating? Well, it turns out if you use heat pumps, you're using like 1/4 the energy as you do with gas heaters. So you don't need as much electricity in the wintertime as you do gas in the wintertime if you use electric heat pumps. So you can mitigate the impacts of the seasonal variation of demand by the fact that you have less demand for energy when you electrify. In fact, if you electrify everything, your power demand goes down about 57% for all sectors. And so on the average for all sectors. So that does help to match power supply with demand on a seasonal timescale.
Speaking of batteries, that has been one of the criticisms on electrifying transportation is about battery disposal. Is that a legitimate concern?
Well, lithium itself is not a toxic metal. I mean, there are other materials in the batteries that are toxic or more of concern. But the idea is to recycle batteries to the extent that they can. So companies like Tesla have a battery recycling program. And I think that's going forward, that's the way to go, is to recycle all the materials or as much as possible. And, you know, but keep in mind, like, in the worst case, if you have, you know, if the battery lasts 10 years or 12 years, and I have an electric car that I've had since 2009, and I had the same original battery pack, so it's lasted at least 10 years. And in the worst case, it's like a one-time both mining and disposal, whereas when you have fossil fuels, you have continuous mining forever and continuous use and continuous disposal, except that disposal is in our air and that we're breathing it in our lungs. So these fossil fuel companies are disposing of their waste in our lungs. And whereas, you know, in the worst case of battery disposal, even if it didn't get recycled, which it should be and definitely want it to be, that is nothing near the order of magnitude of waste that results from the fossil fuel industry.
Any other technologies that you see coming online that are going to help us move to this goal of 100% renewables?
Well, I think the most difficult thing to change is long-distance heavy transportation aircraft in particular, so long-distance aircraft. Now, new aircraft are now available that are electric that can go up to 1,500 kilometers, either electric or hydrogen fuel cell, but we need technologies for further than 1,500 kilometers, you know, up to 10,000 kilometers for some flights, or even more, I think. And that, for those, we would use hydrogen fuel cell. And so those technologies haven't been developed, but they are theoretically possible. And so we expect within the next 15 to 20 years to have long-distance heavy transport. But right now, we don't have it. And that's really one of the very few types of technologies that are not currently available to transition. But I would say we have 95% of the technologies that we need for the transition, and the rest are technically possible. We just haven't commercialized them yet.
Well, Mark Jacobson, it is always such a pleasure to host you. And I thank you so much for your research and for your willingness to share it and to work so hard to transition us into this future of 100% renewables. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. I really appreciate it.
Mark Jacobson is a Stanford University professor of civil and environmental engineering, director of the Atmosphere Energy Program, senior fellow at two institutes for energy and the environment, and the co-founder of the Solutions Project. He has authored two textbooks, over 160 peer-reviewed articles, has testified four times before Congress, and won numerous academic and civic awards for his work. When we come back, a book of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's correspondence reveals the politics of the past and how it has changed. Stay tuned. You are listening to The Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. A book of Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan's correspondence reveals the politics of the past and how it has changed.
Times have changed in Washington, marked by polarized politics and unfriendly rancor. The old school decorum has ostensibly faded. Among the senators who most exemplified the possibility of bipartisanship and big ideas was Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, the longshoreman turned scholar turned politician. A book titled Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary, features one of his most prolific aspects, his letter-writing prowess. Through his letters, he shows a changing Congress and changing world. We have with us the author, a fellow and journalist, Stephen Weissman. Stephen Weissman is editorial director and public policy fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and a former journalist at the New York Times and Time Magazine. Welcome, Stephen Weissman.
Thank you for having me.
It's great to have you. Why don't we start with this kind of larger historical context of Senator Moynihan? The letters seem to paint this picture of a guy who was very bipartisan, who got along pretty much with everybody, worked with both sides. I mean, he's the guy who brought Ralph Nader in to Washington, defended him to the core, and yet worked for Richard Nixon. How do we explain this?
It's hard to explain, but one of the things we learn from these letters is from his diaries, these very early diaries in the 1950s, and these letters go from the 1950s all the way into the 21st century, is that he came from a broken family. His father abandoned him, his family, when Pat Moynihan was only 10, and he never saw him again. He had a feel for impoverished families that were broken, and that became his signature issue all through his career. But it led to something else, I believe, which is that he believed in the institution of government and the stability of government. His whole career was a search for stability, both in his family and in politics. And this led him to hope and support that presidents, even those with whom he disagreed and who were on from the other side of the aisle, should succeed. And that led him, as a lifelong Democrat, to work for Richard Nixon in the hope, which he later believed was somewhat naive, that Richard Nixon could find a new center for American politics at a time of maximum instability, when there were riots in the cities, there were riots on campuses, there was poisonous racial and generational and cultural divisions. He wanted the presidency to succeed.
When we look at this man, and he, you said he then thought maybe he was a little bit naive, but he did seem to have some traction with Nixon.
Oh, he did. You know, one of the things that comes across in these letters is a Nixon that I think a lot of people, certainly your listeners, certainly myself, didn't recognize. But Nixon, in a way, was an intellectual. He's a soldier in the Cold War. He was anti-communist to the core in his early career, which was here in Southern California. Moynihan appealed to his intellectual interests. Moynihan could say to him, you know, what you're trying to do, Mr. President, is similar to what Benjamin Disraeli tried to do in the 19th century British politics, which is engage in social reforms, but as a conservative. And he tried to appeal to Nixon's almost, you might say, intellectual vanity. And Nixon went ahead and read biographies of Benjamin Disraeli and became fascinated
at the urging of Moynihan.
And their relationship, which comes out in these letters, is utterly fascinating. It's different from anything I understood existed before. And when Nixon was ousted and forced out after Watergate in the mid-1970s, Moynihan was ambassador to India, and he gives a wonderful address to the employees of the American Embassy, where he says, look, this man committed impeachable offenses. He had to go. But we who serve in government should remember that Nixon has now become the third president in a row ousted from office or violently taken from office. Kennedy was assassinated. Johnson was ousted by an uprising over the war. Nixon now was impeached. Moynihan said, this is something we should think about because we have to be concerned with the legitimacy of government and government institutions. And I think those words speak to us now so powerfully.
One of the other things I think it captured was that even though there was a strong line between liberals and conservatives or Democrats and Republicans, or however that might be articulated, there was this ability to bridge during that time that doesn't seem to be quite so present anymore.
I think you're right. Moynihan sort of had a tribal view of politics. He was from the tribe of Irish Catholic Democrats in New York grew up in Hell's Kitchen, where everything was going to be determined by whether you were from the Jewish tribe or the Irish tribe or the Italian tribe.
Well, that's right. He wrote about ethnicity as a scholar.
It was his first subject, and when he collaborated with Nathan Glaser, the great Harvard sociologist, on Beyond the Melting Pot, which came out in the early 60s, which understood that ethnicity was the basis of American politics in the cities. And he also, by the way, later understood that it was the basis for national politics all around the world in the Balkans.
International wars.
So he understood that from a variety of perspectives. But there was another aspect of his tribal politics. It's a little different. He understood that politicians themselves were kind of part of a tribe. They understood that the person they were fighting with one day was going to have to be somebody that they'd have to collaborate with the next day. And when you're in a tribe in the Senate or in the House and you have to work with people and get the votes where you can, that reintroduces a sense of civility and even a sense of humor and perspective into politics that we've tended to forget must exist today, where everything is warfare and determined by, if I may say, the exaggerated, almost cartoon-like depictions that you hear too much on cable TV or wherever.
His time was a time when people could be more accommodating for the other side, I think. But it was also partly who he was. I wonder, are there Moynihans today?
I think not, but I like to think that even on both sides, there are those who believed first and foremost in looking at the facts. And Moynihan, one of his signature sayings is, everyone's entitled to their own opinions, but not to their own facts. Of course, what we now have is people who look not only at opinions and facts, but they look at narratives. You know, they selectively look at facts and they put together a narrative. And that's where our politics have gone, sometimes not to the benefit of our political system. There's hardly anyone on the scene like Pat Moynihan today. You know, when he first ran for office in 1976, his opponent tried to belittle him by calling him Professor Moynihan in all their debates and in all his appearances. And Moynihan's response was, well, the mudslinging has begun. So he had a kind of ironic sense of humor, almost, you know, able to diffuse the bitterness of politics. That's also an awfully rare commodity.
I want to go back to Nixon for just a minute.
Sure.
Because one of the letters I thought was pretty remarkable when he said, you know, he had defended Nixon. And he asks, was I a fool or was I a whore or both?
Such a powerful letter. He wrote that as Watergate was sinking the Nixon presidency, and he was sent off to India to be ambassador, which was one of the more interesting, trying, and challenging periods of his life. I lived in India for 3.5 years, and I must say I have a personal love of the letters from India, because while he was engaging in these ethnic issues in India, he was also looking from thousands of miles away from the other side of the globe at this presidency. And he was writing to his best friend, Nathan Glaser, with whom he collaborated on the Beyond the Melting Pot book. And he used those words. Aren't they amazing? I mean, I really felt in doing this book, I knew Pat Moynihan, but I learned something about him as I took this journey through the decades of his career, which was also a journey through the second half of the 20th century, really, of American politics, which was that he was much more anguished, much more hurt, much more proud and self-aware and self-referential than could be understood with his many books and public utterances. You can see through these letters this evolution of his personal passions, but you can also see that the scars and the hurts, and he did feel in the Nixon years, as Nixon was running into the ground, that his own reputation was ruined. It's amazing how it comes across in his personal writings.
His life seems to exemplify several things. One is that American success story from started with
remarkable.
His broken family,
yeah.
And then, you know, became a longshoreman and then became a scholar and then into politics. And so he really is kind of
very unusual.
A poster child of a success story from very humble roots. But there are a few other things that I kind of captured in this. One is, it's both a story of how one person can make a difference and at the same time a story of how hard it is to make a difference.
Well, Pat Moynihan used to say, if you're not willing to put 20 or 30 years into something, to trying to get something enacted, then you don't belong in politics. He worked patiently on issues over a long period of time. He started in the early 1960s writing to Lyndon Johnson about the plight of the African-American family, the Negro family, as he called it in his famous Moynihan report. But it wasn't until the late 1980s that he really brought about changes in the welfare system that he had started to try and bring about. And he spectacularly failed in the Nixon years when they tried to put through the Family Assistance Plan. His career is a testimony to, yes, as you say, kind of up from humble beginnings, but it is also is a testimony to persistence and patience. There's another example of that, which is some of the urban renewal projects, like in Pennsylvania Avenue, which again started in the early 1960s and ended up in the 1990s being completed. And if you've been to Washington today and you see Pennsylvania Avenue with the Willard Hotel and the Ronald Reagan Building all spiffed up and looking great, there's a little place on Pennsylvania Avenue. It's called Daniel Patrick Moynihan Place, just to signal his role in a project like that, which took 25, 30 years to bring to fruition.
Now, if we fast forward his work to the Clinton, he was immensely disappointed in Bill Clinton, it seemed, particularly with the health care bill.
They tangled on that, yes. They had a difference of priorities. Shortly after Clinton took office, Moynihan went on Meet the Press, which was hosted by Tim Russert, who had worked for Pat as a press secretary, and said, there's no health care crisis in this country, which was exactly the opposite of what the White House was saying. That was not a particularly good relationship. They tangled. He tangled with Hillary Clinton. In the end,
he endorsed her.
He endorsed her and really helped to anoint her. And on election night in 2000, the famous Bush v. Gore night, Bill Clinton turned to Pat Moynihan and said, without your endorsement, she wouldn't have won.
Let me remind our listeners that we're speaking with Stephen Wiseman, and the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait in Letters of an American Visionary. You know, I think this array of letters shows us the inner workings of government and
the inner
workings of relationships. And you go way back into, I think this was an RFK letter where he talks about J. Edgar Hoover was who it was.
Oh,
who
yes,
would send
yes.
these photographs.
Incriminating information about Martin Luther King, I think. And
the one memo was about J. Edgar Hoover sending regular reports about RFK's sex life just to show they were watching him.
Yeah.
Tells us a lot about how Washington works, I think.
You know, Pat Moynihan had a very bad relationship with the FBI and the CIA. In 1979, Pat Moynihan predicted that the Soviet Union would fall. That was a good more than a decade before it fell. An amazing example of his ability to prophesy things before they happen. Going back to the early 1950s, actually, there's a great letter where when he was a student in London, he had a Fulbright. And he's very concerned because he's been told that there have been intelligence reports that he might be cavorting with communists. And of course, if you were a student in London in the early 1950s, you would I mean, there was a pretty strong left wing and a labor movement which had communist elements in it. So he really felt that red baiting, he really hated red baiting throughout his career. And it made him very unsympathetic to the FBI. So he takes note of that with Bobby Kennedy, just in signaling to him in that letter that you mentioned, watch out for Hoover. Watch out for the FBI. It's a really great little moment there.
It actually makes the dark side of Washington kind of appear in little tiny pieces.
Yeah, that's right. Well, and also Moynihan's relationship with the Kennedys. As I say in my introduction, you know, there's a certain generation, and I would include myself in this, for whom, you know, John F. Kennedy really pulled the sword from the stone. That was what Camelot was all about. It's hard to imagine. I guess there was a little bit of that in 2008 with the early idealism about President Obama. But for Kennedy, it just hit the country and it hit the generation that Moynihan was in. And the assassination of John F. Kennedy in 1963 was so devastating to that generation and to Pat Moynihan, whose words on that occasion still echo and are still moving. And there are these letters and transcripts of his comments then. He was only an obscure assistant secretary of labor, but when in an interview he said, "I don't suppose there's any point in being Irish if you don't know the world is going to break your heart. I just thought we had more time." That couple of sentences really still sends chills through me because it's so moving. And Pat Moynihan's eloquence in public, but also in these letters, it really comes to life.
When you look at the book in whole now, from beginning to end, what do you think it tells us about the policymaking process and how it's changed?
I think it tells you how complicated and how much patience you need. But it also, I think Moynihan's signal contribution is something that was also an amazing discovery in these letters. In the 1980s, he gave some lectures at Harvard. And then in the last month of his life, when it seems to me he understood that the end was near, because he was sick for quite some period in and out of hospitals, he writes, "In 40 years of government service, I've learned one thing, and that is that the conservative axiom of American politics is that culture, not politics, determines the success of a society, but that the liberal truth is that politics can save a culture from itself." And then he says something really important, which runs through his career and really is the answer to your question, which is that these two truths together strengthen our society. As he writes, I think, "They may have made us a stronger country than we would have otherwise been." And I think that after this toxic period that we've gone through, where it's been so divisive and we're so appalled at the fury of disagreement, I think the one contribution Pat Moynihan might have made to this debate is, hey, look, this is the way we debate things. We've been debating the role of government since Alexander Hamilton and Thomas Jefferson. This is not bad for us to do. This is good for us to do. How else are we going to solve these our problems except by having these debates? But he would also say they should be based on facts.
Right. Well, great. I think that's a perfect place to end. Stephen Weissman, thank you so much for coming in. Again, the book is called Daniel Patrick Moynihan, A Portrait and Letters of an American Visionary. It's a collection of his letters.
Thank you so much for having me. It's fun to talk to you.
Thank you.
And that's it for today's show. Thank you to all of our guests and to those who make this program possible. To Sud Dongre, our webmaster, Ankine Arasyan, Melissa Chiprin, Mike Hurst, and Tim Page, most of all, thank you for listening. If you missed part of the show, you can check out our archives at scholarcircle.org, kpfk.org, and please like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at Armudian, and we'll see you next week.
Basin Street is a street where all them characters from the first precinct meet. In New Orleans, city of a million dreams, and you never know how nice it seems when you're way down south in New Orleans and you be hugging and a kissing. That's what I've been missing. Hear all that good music, Lord, if you just listen.